everybody. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. It is the ninth day of April, 2024. The sun is kind of shining here in the Land of Israel. I know if you were somewhere in the continental United States yesterday, you had the experience of the sun not necessarily shining all day, and that must have been way cool. We didn't feel that at all here in the Holy Land. It is also the first day of Nisan, so it is officially back in the day. This would have been the new year, the official new year, the beginning of spring, Passover in a couple of weeks, new beginnings, and let's hope 5784, obviously, and let's hope there really will be new beginnings and good things and good tidings, as it seems like so many things are like spiraling out of control. And I've put the world into three categories at the moment: the Jews and our supporters, idiots, and evil people. Idiots is probably the largest group. I know you're not, my listeners are not among them. And anyway, so we're just trying to educate and see if the inmates at some point will stop running the asylum that we call the earth. So when I was in Miami last month on the plane on the way back, I normally don't talk to the people who are sitting next to me, but there was this really lovely lady who was sitting near me, and poor thing, I had to climb over her to get out to the aisle. And we started talking until I took my sleeping pill for a few hours, and then she got a break. And it turns out that this lovely lady is Patty Chamberlain, whom afterwards, when I got off the plane, I Googled her, and I was like, wow, way cool. But we had an amazing talk, and I asked her if she would honor us with being on the podcast today. And so she is. She is in Tel Aviv, and she's going to tell us a little bit about what she was doing on that plane with me, and just in general, the fabulously interesting trajectory that her life has taken. So, Patty, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, my pleasure, friend. My pleasure.
So we've been trying to get together since I got home and you got to Israel, but you are one busy lady. So maybe a little bit of your background, like how you ended up on that flight, and then we'll talk about what you've been doing in the last few weeks.
Absolutely, positive. Well, I think I'm going to start from October 8th.
Okay.
Okay, with you. I was up in Traverse City, Michigan, the cherry capital of the world.
Oh, I didn't know.
Oh, yes.
Michigan is the cherry capital of the world?
No, not Michigan, Traverse City.
Traverse City,
yeah,
okay.
Look at the hand. It's up 100 miles south of the Mackinac Bridge near the Canadian border. And there was one Jewish family when I was growing up. And she was my best friend. So I was spending time in a Jewish household before I understood what that meant. But anyway. I was there, and I had Israel 24 television, which I'd had before, subscribed. I was up there because my sons are there, and I was going to rent that place, that little cupboard of a condo up there, because I live in Florida, and my activities in my Jewish faith in Florida have really taken off in such a wonderful way that my life is so complete. My kids can come see me. They can come see me. I don't need to go up there. So when I watched what was going on in Israel, when I woke up, I knew kids that had died. There was no question, because of my intense musical connections in Israel and my intense personal relationships with kids in that age group that were at the Nova Music Festival. My ex-partner has two sons. I worked with them all over Israel in big events, you know, not trans-psychedelic music, but lots of things. I've sung all over the place here, and I'm a singer. I'm an opera singer by trade. That's what I've done. Music runs in my blood, the music of the church runs in my blood. I'm the daughter of it's a long story. The short version is my grandfather was a Church of Christ minister in Northern Michigan. And but from the very beginning, he would always talk about stories from the Old Testament. And I fell in love with the Old Testament very young. Everything happens in our world of knowing that God is everything. There's no life, there's nothing, there's no air we breathe, there's no water to drink without having the presence of God in you. That's where I come from. That's how I was born. That's how I thought. So anyway, once I started getting older and older, my parents told me that I was adopted. And it was a wild thing in those days, prehistoric dragons. When I hope I'm not speaking too fast.
No.
Excited telling stories.
So compared to me, you're doing great.
Okay. Well, I don't know that. So anyway, I just began to sing in Church of Christ, by the way. A lot of the more strict congregations don't allow music.
Really?
So you sing a cappella. You sing a cappella.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, I knew early on this would never work for me because I had to have the music. But I think it was, you know, God worked so young in my life. I mean, it was always about learning more about the Old Testament, learning more about the music of the Old Testament. And, you know, so for so many of us that didn't have a Jewish background, we didn't know what we were saturating and learning about Moses, about Elijah, about every character that you were grown up with, you know, going to being raised in a shul like you were.
Right.
So, okay, I'm going to lose myself because I'm getting.
Wait, so let me interrupt you for a second, because what you just said fascinates me about the music of the Old Testament. Because yeah. One of the things that I'm interested in is the music of the ancient time, which, from what I understand, we don't really have. I mean, we could see what they saw and maybe eat what they ate and smell what they smelled. But
correct.
The music.
It's the lyrics. It's the text.
Okay. Okay.
The texts. The Lord is my shepherd. Hear ye, uh-huh. Israel. All of those texts have changed with the times. And you're right. And we haven't done a great job with it sometimes. You
mm-hmm.
know, it's been handed to musical enterprises who think they know more than some of us do. When you sing in the spirit, when you perform musically, no, you know, whether it's a biblical text or it's Mozart, there's always a sacred place in making music. And when you are in that sacred place, we say the soul speaks, it bypasses the brain, and the soul speaks through music. There's no brain in it. And
right.
For me personally, there are moments, and they all, I mean, this sounds kind of crazy. Well, you know, it's crazy time. So
yes,
I'm going to let it hang out.
It fits right in. Exactly.
But I can remember in eighth grade standing up with the orchestra and singing, "Hear ye, Israel, hear what the Lord speaketh. Oh, hast thou heeded my commandments?" I mean, things like that were put in me at such a young age.
Wow. Wow.
And so that seems to me at this point in my life, all of those moments led up to right now.
Yes.
Not 10 years from now, not 15 years ago, 30 years ago, not even 50 years ago. I mean, everything came to now because I fell in love with those texts. I continued to learn about the Old Testament. I've been a spiritual mutt because even though it was always calling me, I was, you know, I've been in a spirit-filled community. I've made the logical. I made that spiritual bridge from, but this was not narrow. This was a very wide bridge from Church of Christ to a cool Lutheran story, Lutheran's Missouri Synod Lutheran.
Excuse my ignorance, but what
yes.
does that entail, moving from one
okay,
to the other? What is the difference?
A heck of a lot, honey.
Okay.
So, I mean, there's the synods, especially within Lutheran or Presbyterian, well, all of them really, but things have changed a lot since I was doing it. They're just a little bit more, it's sort of Reform, conservative, you know, all the way to the Haredim, I mean,
mm-hmm.
it's the whole shebang.
Okay.
But it depends on where you are. You know, when you're living in a small community, I went to high school at a place called North Carolina School of the Arts in Winston-Salem, North Carolina. And I became very involved in a fabulous Baptist church there. I was in the minority ethnically, but when it came to music, nobody cares. Nobody cared.
Great.
So I've sort of seen it all and done it all through music. But I was always called to the Jewish faith. In college, I started in Cleveland Institute of Music, then was convinced that I was going to be the next Beverly Sills, moved to New York City because my teacher was going to be at Juilliard, studied voice every day, and went to all the Jewish congregations all over New York City. And then I heard the Cantors. Then I heard, you know, Park Avenue Synagogue. And I mean, I heard the old timers, and
right.
There was still a lot of Yiddish being sung in New York in those days.
Mm-hmm.
So my ears started getting filled with this music. But I had not converted. I just knew that I had this attraction. So of course the next logical thing was to find a Jewish boyfriend, which I always seemed to do, no matter where I was. They just, I'm not going to get into all of that, you know, but I was so interested in how the cultural side of them was, it didn't divide itself in my eyes from religion. And I don't even like the word religion, you know, what your spiritual identity is, you know.
Yeah.
I noticed that no matter what, I mean, he was out wild and crazy and we'd go dancing, we'd do all these things, but come Shabbat, man, he was home.
Hmm.
And I just loved that. And that was the beginning of understanding more about the Jewish culture, I think, really, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So, oh gosh, you know, I don't know where to go next.
So, okay, when's the first time you come to Israel?
First time I came to Israel, I was hired in 2006.
Okay.
I was the Ave Maria girl. I did a lot of Ave Marias around. I sang on cruise ships and I sang opera with some good orchestras all over the United States. But my apprenticeship, really, my seasoning was in Europe, because in those days, if you sang opera, that you moved to Germany. It was then the West. And once you got started, then you would be swinging in France and Switzerland. And I lived in Geneva, Switzerland for several years, in Freiburg in West Germany. And I just honed my skills, came back to the United States and started realizing, you know, I love opera and I love dressing up and I love the makeup and I love the you know, I love all that.
The show.
But I was always called to sacred music. Always. And in the classical world of music, you know, we have, which I was just singing a minute ago, Elijah, this oratorio. And as you become more and, well, maybe as we all get more involved in our lives, it's so interesting to find out the other parts to what happened before. And when you start learning about some of the composers, so many of them went through times like this.
Really?
Barbaric times, you know, where they had to hide their identities. You know, there were so many incredible Jewish composers that were lost in the Holocaust. You know, they'd been forgotten because the music was never saw its life. They died.
Mm-hmm.
But I could go on and on about the composers. But Mendelssohn, the composer of Elijah, for instance, was born Jewish.
Right.
But had to, you know, negate that idea for many, many years. But towards the end of his life, he came back to it. But in the meantime, God gave him this voice. So the Oratorio of the Elijah, the one that probably most of your listeners know, is the Messiah. Well, proper way to say it is Messiah.
Mm-hmm.
Messiah. Handel, George Frederick Handel. Not Handel, kiddies, it's Handel. And the music is all biblical text. But because it's probably the most important oratorio that every orchestra, from a community orchestra to the greatest orchestras in the world, do, and it's done in German, and it's English was what it was written in, but the texts stay with you. So it opens up a population of maybe non-believers, of agnostics, of atheists, to listen to biblical texts.
Wow.
That's what I love to do. And so I sang a lot of oratorios on stage, once in Elijah, just at the highest note. Do you want to hear this? I don't know.
Yes, absolutely. I'm fascinated.
But God spoke always to me, always. And, you know, you go through periods of times where you get stuck back in the world, blah, blah, blah. And you kind of, you know, the word Satan can come up.
Yes.
You know, we can talk about it in the environment I was raised in. It was very real. And so you'd say, you know, Satan's at my back or blah, 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 blah. But for whatever your beliefs are on that subject, and they're vast, I know for a fact that I had some warfare going on stage. Once in the highest note, this fly flew in my mouth. And
ooh.
I am the Lord. Stuff like that. But, you know, I remember it looking back, thinking, oh, that's so bizarre. That's so bizarre. But, you know, I'm a little bit out there about this stuff, because when you're on stage and things happen supernaturally, you just pay attention to them. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I always knew that. Anyway, I came to Israel at the invitation of wonderful music lovers, philanthropists from California. He is Israeli. His papa was running arms onto the Haifa beach.
During the War of Independence?
During
wow.
War of Independence, you know, so he has stories. And his wife was, let's just put it this way, Elvis was her godfather.
Okay.
End of story.
Okay.
And the pictures prove it. You know, they got married. He and Priscilla got married at her father's apartment, who owned a hotel in Las Vegas. So they have these, you know, not that I'm impressed with any of that, except that I was impressed with that.
Mm-hmm.
Because what they do in their lives is bring people that have never been to Israel that they like playing golf with, or, you know, they put their money where their mouth is.
Mm-hmm. It's called influencers. And
it's
maybe.
Called, yeah, well, it was
modern,
that, such
in
a
modern
word.
Rhetoric, right.
Yeah, in
right.
Modern rhetoric. I don't like that word.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know why, because everybody thinks they're an influencer all of a sudden. But you are. Well, you've been.
No, but this. I'm just thrilled to have you on.
Me, darling. You've influenced me. You've
okay.
influenced me greatly, okay. Because you gave me great courage in times exactly when I needed it. So backing off on that. When
you
I
were on that plane.
Yes, I was.
So I
yes,
think I just maybe, you know, you weren't going to get off the plane. I didn't notice a parachute. But
no.
But I think you were having some of the doubts about how rational it was to be coming to Israel at this time.
Yes. Well,
and we worked that out by the time we landed. Yes.
I sure did.
Mm-hmm.
I sure did. I loved sitting next to you. It was my great gift. So,
likewise.
So we'll get back to Ave Maria. And I began singing. They would bring... people from, mostly from California and from the golf club in Cabo San Lucas, you know, very expensive trip, but they invited me to come sing Ave Maria. So I sang at the Basilica, the Catholic Church in Nazaret, in Bethlehem, in Domus Galilee, Yad Vashem.
Wow.
And a beautiful place up in the old city, a beautiful exotic gallery. You know, overlooking the hotel. I can't remember the name of it, but that's how I began to see Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And everything changed. My singing changed. The way I thought about the text changed. And I fell in love with this country. I just fell in love with this country. And I knew that all of the Judaism that I'd been kind of keeping down.
Right.
In me, I never felt it personally. I never felt a part of anything until I came here and I was with the Jewish people. And I can't put it into words. I still can't. Maybe when I talk to God about this at one point, we'll discuss it. But I think that all of that was the groundbreaking, complete change of my life. Complete.
Wow. That you know, I'm wondering, it's because... So one of the things we spoke about on the plane is you heard me talking to the steward in Hebrew.
Okay.
And you said to me, oh, you speak Hebrew. Like there was such a sense of longing in your voice. You said to me, you know, I've tried so hard and I'm going to keep going and I really want to speak Hebrew. And I'm wondering if when you came to Israel and you heard the language of the Bible all around you, just being spoken, you know, the vernacular, the whatever, if that was part of what touched something inside you.
It was a huge part. Mm-hmm. It was a huge part. And I remember a couple of moments when I could take words like Refushlema and
Mitzvah. Right. Have a full recovery. Mama. Yes.
Yes. All of these words that it would take in English a paragraph to like explain or to it's one word in Hebrew. And it would like come off my lips and my tongue in a way. See, even the way I'm speaking about it right now, it just gives me such a sense of peace and understanding.
Yes, your cadence changed. Yes, it did.
So, see, that makes me cry.
That's okay. I've already cried today. You can join me.
Honor your emotions. So with that, then that was it. And I was on a group of, you know, I didn't just come on a little, get on a bus and go around. I was with very wealthy people. I was the 100th man. And it was my great gift to see it from, you know, the most incredible, what money can buy here is observation decks.
Yes.
And
yes.
Caves and places that the layman doesn't get to go to.
Off the beaten track. Yeah.
Yes, that's exactly right. So that's how I saw it. And they started doing the trip every year. So I came every year I did four of them. And then, of course, on the third one, I fell in love with a Sabra. And I was already in love with this. And should we talk romantic vibration?
Whatever you'd like.
Okay. All right. You'll edit, honey.
Or not.
No. Okay. So, but I was seeing Israel from a reserve. I was seeing someone who had served his country since age 17, and he was 56 or 57 then, and in so many different areas and ways. I didn't understand it all then, but he had a son who was still in the IDF, medical paratrooper, and his other son had served and was kind of running this production company where they do things all over the world.
Well, extreme activities. Right.
Right. But they're all Jewish oriented to groups. Like a family would take their daughter to Sicily to a UNESCO site, and they would work it out to do a bat mitzvah there with her coming
oh,
in.
Oh, how beautiful. Oh,
I mean,
how beautiful.
You can't even imagine. It's Cirque du Soleil on steroids.
Wow.
But from a Jewish point of view for events. So when I started seeing, I was very lucky. I was blessed to be able to see that idea of how life is celebrated. Life is celebrated with it, and these were Jewish families from Panama, from Argentina, from California, from New York. Some with lots of money, some with very little money, and they always worked it out because when they met the right chemistry, they would do these things. So that was what I saw. When I fell in love with this man, it was because we'd been working together for a while as colleagues and professionals. And you know that line about you got to be friends first? Well, I really do believe that. I think it's really true. It was true in my case. So we started a two continent relationship. I came here for 2 months and 20 days at a time. He would come to, at that point, I was living in Florida, to 2.5 months in the summers, and we'd go up to Michigan. I was divorced in 2008, got out of a alcoholic marriage, and it was, you know, he was the big guy, and it was just a really rough breakup. I had sole custody of two boys. Our two boys are Guatemalan born because I'm adopted. It always seemed natural to me, just natural to me. And he had kids
to adopt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He had two children from previous marriage, wonderful kids. I adore them. And he was working a lot. And I was standing on my head for a couple of months, wasn't getting pregnant. And so I said, could we talk about adoption? Well, sure. You know, I think it's a good idea. He was on board. So we were in a Chinese international adoption program for almost a year. And if you all know about international adoptions, it depends on the politics and the money involved.
Right. So
at one point, China closed its doors. Guatemala opened it a little bit wider. We were adopting one little Guatemalan boy. I went over and worked in the orphanage. A wonderful, by the way, Baptist-run orphanage from Arkansas. And again, had these relationships with people that knew texts of the Bible, you know, in Guatemala. And they love God in Guatemala. I mean, spirit-filled.
Yes.
They love God.
Yeah.
And they know Israel. I mean, they know what they know.
Mm-hmm.
They know that they have a love for Israel. That's what they know.
It's not complicated by all the noise.
Oh,
it's very
no.
pure from what
simple.
I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. Very simple. And you see them here. You see them in Jerusalem. They
mm-hmm.
save the money their whole lives.
Right.
To come to the old city, you know,
yeah.
to the locations of the cross. So anyway, at the very last minute, we found out he had a brother. So I became an instant mother of a 3 and a 4 year old. At an age when many women were starting menopause.
How old are they now, the boys?
They are 30 and almost 32.
Mm-hmm.
And wonderful boys. And one has a cognitive learning disability, but he's right on the cusp of functioning pretty fully now. He's the older one. And the other boy's great. He's been to Israel with me several times. And he really wanted to try to, you know, he just fell in love with the idea and
mm-hmm.
became obsessed with the idea. He went back and joined the U.S. Army.
Wow.
And
so you really, you saved them. You changed their lives, what you did.
They saved
you, really.
They
it's
saved
beautiful.
They saved me.
Wow.
And they're the loves of my life, you know. So,
mm-hmm. So you
actually,
divorced their dad, and then you moved towards
dad.
Judaism?
I moved to Florida. My parents mm-hmm. were in Florida, and he couldn't tell me where I couldn't go. And so I moved to Florida and had my parents very close. And they were amazing with my children. And it allowed me to, when opportunities like coming to Israel, you know, for a month would come up, they adored coming to stay at my house. And my mother would make her lists for the children. And it was just a gift. It was a gift.
Mm-hmm.
And so that allowed me to continue my career.
Right.
That's what it did. And I sang more in Israel in those years and did a lot of teaching in South Florida, in Tampa. And the other thing I should say is that the University of South Florida in Tampa had one of the first international refugee status things where Iran, Iraq, I mean, all the biggies were giving millions and millions and millions of dollars to the universities,
mm-hmm.
to this one in particular. I can remember when they would like stand in front of the Hillel and like shun the kids that were going in on Shabbat.
Well, and now that whole thing is coming to fruition. So those
oh.
decades that they invested in the universities have made the universities an incredibly uncomfortable place for the Jewish students. And that's
incredibly.
The least of it.
And
it's
for the most part been a lot about the money.
Mm-hmm.
It's been a lot about the money, you know. The countries that really hate us found a way a long time ago to infiltrate our universities and our kids. And I've seen it firsthand I've seen it too much now to know that in our country, I believe, is our biggest danger.
Mm-hmm.
Because the enemy goes after the vulnerable Westerner who thinks that having peace and a civil society is the norm, that it's
right.
not a special gift.
No.
Peace is not the norm.
No,
peace.
You're not entitled to it. You have to work.
Not
you have to fight very hard for peace. That's what people in the West don't understand.
I didn't understand. No one
mm-hmm.
no one does. Well, I should say no one in my family does. How's that?
Right.
my children.
But did you pay a price professionally for your pro-Israel and eventually, you know, spoiler alert, joining the Jewish people for your stance?
I think that I was just on the outside. I may have early on and didn't know it because I have felt like an outsider for so long.
Mm-hmm.
That if it were coming my way in those days, I don't think I would have known. Mm-hmm. However, when I watched firsthand in my life with my children, what was happening when we went to Israel, for instance, and for the first time, when I brought the boys, we did all these IDF things, and you know, they were part of his family, and they were
right.
With teams, you know, after IDF, these boys and girls have to make a living.
Yes.
And they all do. They know they're you know, they know what to do. So my boys were so impressed because they were impressionable. And the impressionable of those ages, you know, they were here for the first time when they were 16 and 17, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
But one of them wasn't out of high school yet, I remember that. They went back and people thought they were crazy. Is your mother crazy? Because even then the idea of Israel was a warmongering idea.
Right.
What we didn't know it was then, it was just Jew hatred. It was anti-Semitic shit. That's been, whoops.
Yeah.
Sue me. I used to sue my children when they'd say that word. They had to put a dollar in the kitchen thing, in the kitchen space. But even then, and I remember my ex-husband screaming at me, what are you doing taking them to Israel? Are you crazy? Blah, 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 blah. You know, they love war there. What are they going to do? Take a break? You know, just to see you? I mean, just the ignorance.
Right.
Which was anti-Semitism. I mean, it was just... So I think that was the first time I really felt badly. And I would always go back up to Michigan. There's a place called Interlochen Center for the Arts, which is, other than where I was, North Carolina School for the Arts, Interlochen Center for the Arts is in northern Michigan. Anybody that's had kids that want to go to the best music, dance, art, theater camp, want to go to Interlochen. And it's
okay.
A boarding school. But I would go there in the summers. And when I was there as a camper, it was the last of the great Yiddish singers and the great choral conductors of Jewish music, the composers of Jewish music, the high holy days, Gosingers, all of the places where, you know, you'd go for Rosh Hashanah and the music and the food and the greatest cantors in the United States. Well, they would come there. And so I had all this music in my mind. But when I went back as a performer, I mean, from an apprentice to a fellow to a pro, and also at the Aspen Music Festival. That's different. That's a different subject. But they were like, we don't want to. No, we don't want that. You know, we want this the stuff that the children, the kids want, you know, what they're calling for. And it's none of that. You know, they want to hear more of the world music. And I remember hearing some Arabic music, and my instant reaction was, no. And that was maybe wrong, because within a music theory course, you know, a historical music background in education, we learn it all. But for some reason, knowing the attitude that he had, and this was somebody that he I think he started his career there and he died there. Let's just put it there, and very high up. His distaste for anything Jewish. I thought, oh my gosh, that's how things are changing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So as you see, I've marked it all musically.
I see that.
Yeah. But when I was working more and more and more, especially in Florida, I wrote and produced I'm going to share this because we have those moments that we're not supposed to, I don't know, who knows, the idea of connecting dots. But when October 7th happened, for me personally, dots started connecting. And I remember vividly after my show, I wrote and produced a show, And I'm sure you've heard, you know, grab your coat and get your hat, leave your worries on the doorstep. What else? I'm in the mood for love.
Oh, for sure.
Simply because you're near me. What else? Oh, I can't give you anything but love, baby. And this gal, Dorothy Fields is her name, wrote all these words, not the music, all these words. Then 30 years later, in her 60s, she hooked up with one of the men that still wanted her on the bubble because none of the other men were available, Cy Coleman, who's a great American Jewish composer. When he wrote, she wrote the lyrics to it, the manager walked in the joint, I could see you were a girl of distinction, a real big spender, you know, so. Anyway, I was infatuated with her because she was Jewish. She was the daughter of a vaudeville, very famous comedian. Well, vaudeville wasn't all comedy. It was music. It was dance. It was
right.
Theater. But she was raised in a family pre-Holocaust where they just said, don't make any waves about being Jewish.
Mm.
Just keep it quiet. Now, this was
yeah.
before the Holocaust, mind you. But when the Holocaust began, you know, they had to keep working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, keep working. So, and of course, in the Great Depression, all this stuff happened. Anyway, they moved to California, and they were kind of living. I mean, they had George Gershwin down the street, Jerome Kern around the block. You know, the greatest composers. And then there was all these film composers that were Jewish that had gotten out of the Holocaust in time, you know, and directors. Everybody was Jewish. Just kind of kept quiet about it. But when the Holocaust happened, there was really a, they say hell in paradise. Because, you know, they were there. They were supposed to be happy and with their sunglasses on. But they were getting these wires and these telegrams that, you know, this is happening and this is happening and this is happening and this is happening. So, and of course, we didn't have podcasts and we didn't
mm-hmm.
have
social
podcasts.
Media or anything.
Nothing.
Yeah.
So, oh, is that me? Sorry, let's
no,
get
no. Your phone is ringing? It's okay.
Got it. Sorry.
It's okay.
Oh, sorry. So, anyway. She knew that she had to roll up her sleeves, and she became she was a fixture. They called her mother at the canteen, American canteen, where all the soldiers in World War II would go in and out, and she would tell them stories about the Jewish faith and what they were doing, and just say, "You've got to keep fighting. You've got to keep fighting this war because nobody's
wow.
winning." So she had this voice, and they didn't, you know, they didn't know anything. Anything for the most part at that point. And also she raised so much money. Oh my God. She would hook up with the in those days it was the wives. She was a one career woman. She was always on the bubble. She was probably the greatest lyricist of her time, but it was only when Rodgers and Hammerstein split up and Jerome Kern was between partners, lyricists, and as far back as Jimmy McHugh, I mean, all of these great composers, it was a man's world. It was a man's world. So she was always first substitute because she was so darn good. But when she realized her voice, that was her time for her voice. She found her voice then, as lyricist, you know, minded as she was making money. She was the only successful lyricist in these times, the only one in California with a big film studios, et cetera, et cetera. And she had a voice and she put it to work. But there were, in the meantime, there were all of these musicians that were trying to get out of Holocaust Europe. And she behind the scenes, she did so much for musicians and artists to get out of Europe. But nobody ever knew all her stories. So I decided I was going to tell her story on stage. And I'm kind of the, well, I'm not an intellectual. I'm not rich. I'm not that smart. I'm not that talented. I mean, in comparison to the greats, but I know that if I just keep going and if God wants me to do something, I'll do it. I can do it because that's what I'm supposed to do. So I wrote a show and I produced the show and I cast the show and I put it on the stage at the Kravis Center for the Performing Arts in West Palm Beach.
When was this?
This was right before COVID, 2019.
Okay.
And the script I wrote was pretty much telling everything, saying everything I just said to you.
Mm-hmm.
But in between great scenes with great singers, I had a great director, a black director who I know and have worked with, who's a Broadway. Her name's Avery Summers. She's a Broadway vet, a singer, but it was an interesting dichotomy for us to work together. And she was able to bring a Broadway look to it as far as costuming and everything. And so I told these stories on a stage about a woman and her Judaism and what she had to do when the call was there. And so,
gee, this sounds familiar. Just saying. Mm-hmm.
So it was a big success and sold out. And it got the attention of some people that you know, that was the great thing. It was due to go to public audiences, which means that you do test audiences before it can go to New York. And then COVID happened.
Ugh.
And long story short, as time went on, and you know, we all know what happened in COVID, you know, we changed in many ways. I started working with someone that was gonna help me get it to the next level, also has produced an impresario. But the one thing he kept saying to me, and I, you know what, I kind of needed the money because, you know, you got to get yourself going. It's kind of like taking out a mortgage for a house you're never going to own until you have the money to buy it and then you sell it at a return. It's kind of the way it sometimes works. And he said, okay, but you got to take this part. It's just too Jewish. It's just too Jewish. You can't do that. It's too Jewish. You know, you gotta stick to the story. The story is about music. I said, yeah, but I wouldn't be telling the story if it weren't for Dorothy Fields and her Jewishness. And so I kept honing it down. I was in COVID. We'd had these Zoom meetings. I was depressed. I was alone. My dog died. My kids were in Michigan. Blah, blah, blah. And I just lost myself in wanting to get it on stage. So I took some of that stuff out. And you know, once I took it out, it was like a balloon. No, not once I took it out. It was over a period of time. It deflated supernaturally.
Mm-hmm.
Just deflated. I no longer had interest in it. I no longer cared that I was talking to the biggest attorney that was going to help me in New York to, you know, with all the rights and blah, blah, blah. I can't tell you. It was like I just melted to the ground and I didn't have any meaning. I don't know. I'm speaking very creatively.
No, yeah, no, but. It once something is acceptable to everybody, it has no flavor anymore. It has nothing unique about it.
It's easier said than done because flavor is flavor. And but then, so it never really worked until, and I've already come back to Israel. I've come back once, very briefly. And it was between the, it was after the, you had two lockdowns. It was after the second lockdown. I came back, still kind of trying to resurrect the last of that Bashir, you know, because looking back, I had fallen in love with Israel. And he's a man that lives in Israel, but he's just a man. And I desperately wanted to be here. Looking back, I desperately wanted to be in Israel and I wanted to be with the Jewish people here in Israel. I didn't necessarily need to be with him, but I didn't know that then. So I came back one more in desperate attempt, didn't work. And I had a broken heart, but I think that's when God really, really pulled my music out of me in the Jewish lyrics. You know, I started listening I mean, I always listened to Idan Reichel. I interviewed Idan Reichel. I know Maya Abraham, his one of his
Right.
backers.
A lot of the popular Israeli singers who also sing to biblical verses. Rock
Very much
music
so.
to biblical verses. Yeah.
But that's the difference. They have, especially the musical, the persons, the people that can put their arrangements together have that same lyricist mentality in their blood. We don't necessarily have that. We don't have it. Look, I love Sandy Patty. There's so many Christian music. Oh, I grew up, Amy Grant's my friend. I sang with Amy Grant.
Wow.
Anybody, any of your singers know Amy Grant and Vince Gill. We were in Cabo together. I did benefits with him. And I, in those days, didn't understand that she was singing El Shaddai. She knew this audience had some American Jews. I knew that too, but I didn't know enough to not stand up because I was so, I sang, you know we are Christians by our love, and you know we are Christians by our love. And I'll never forget, she looked at me for a minute, kind of surprised, and then she gave me a, because that was
nod.
My truth, you know?
Right.
And we prayed together, Vince and Amy and I, and held hands, and he's the most gracious, amazing, God-fearing, wonderful man. He was always famous. But, you know, since he joined the Eagles, honey, he's famous. So, you know, I had all these musical encounters. But what I remembered then is the American evangelical Christians that love Amy Grant. I could go on and on about all the ones I love. But they love us sharing, and they love Israel, and they love the musical part of any text. And she really showed that. I have to say. So I was sort of unafraid then. But I skipped around because that was before I went through conversion.
Right. So what actually pushed you to do that? Because, you know, you're clearly a God person and a spiritual person your entire life. I mean, since your earliest memories.
Yes.
And you loved Israel. But there's a lot of people who love Israel who are God people who don't actually want to become Jewish. So,
yes.
And, you know, it wasn't like you were raising your kids Jewish or anything. You were past all that. It was a really deeply
right.
personal decision.
Yes.
And it wasn't because you were going to marry a Jewish guy and he was telling you had to convert.
Nope.
It wasn't any of that.
Nope. Nope.
So do you remember what?
Yes, I do. It was after one of my trips to Israel. And I remember going to Yad Vashem. And I remember being the docent, I don't know what the word is in Hebrew, but
like the person who takes you around. It's the
yeah.
it's the Holocaust Memorial Museum.
Yes, the Holocaust Memorial
in Jerusalem.
In Jerusalem, and it which is unlike any other experience about the Holocaust. And I remember she was well into her 80s, and she had a voice I'll never forget, with an accent. And I was telling she was interested in me, and she knew that I was singing, in Israel. And she said, I'm not going to say what she said, but she looked at me and she said, so are you going to convert to Judaism? And I looked
just like
at her,
that?
Just like that. At the very end, the very end.
Wow.
Because part of, you know, sometimes we need encouragement from exactly the right human at exactly the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not an intellectual. When I make up my own mind about what I want to learn, which is not always good. But I wanted to learn about the Holocaust. I had this need to learn about the Holocaust. It was a deep hunger. And so when I went to Yad Vashem, I had questions things I didn't understand. And I remember, you could tell she'd been doing this a long time, and sometimes she never got short with people, but she knew that if she said something that was most Jews would know, that she had to say it in kindness. But I knew that after I asked a couple of questions, she knew that I knew what I know. She knew that I knew what I know, and that I was hungry. And the last couple of questions were about Kristallnacht. I remember that, and then certain days and things that happened. And she said, "Okay, I want to talk to you." And She told me more about conversion, and I already knew in Tampa, Florida, because I'd been going to a synagogue, a Reformed synagogue, that I loved being there. I enjoyed it, and I hadn't really told my whole adoption story until Rabbi Bechholz, who's now retired in Tampa, I want to hear your story. I want to hear your story. And I told him, and he said, well, you have Jewish blood. Have you done 23andMe?
Right.
Well, no, because I'm afraid. Because I'm afraid, because if I'm not, where does this, if I don't have any Jewish blood, I'm going to be so disappointed. You know, he said, no, no. He said, it doesn't work.
No, it doesn't.
And he said, if you are a Jew, what choice? He said, you don't worry about the other people.
Mm-hmm.
The whole people will know who you are.
Your DNA doesn't change when you become Jew by choice. You're still Irish, Catholic, whatever.
That's right.
Your soul changes, not your DNA.
But I also knew that well, in later years, what you just said is holy knowledge. But there are a lot of cultural Jews that were tormented having to go to synagogue when they were young.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard stories of young families at the holidays being locked into doors until they gave money. So, you know,
ooh,
just like nightmarish.
Yes.
That some, you know, Christians have.
Of course.
Catholics have.
Of course.
There's also nightmares.
No, there's a tremendous emotional component. And if for you, religion of any sort was marked by some kind of abuse, mental, physical, whatever, you are going to be against that religion. It's a discussion I've had many years. My listeners have heard me rail on that. The responsibility the religious leaders have, because if they represent that religion or represent God to people and they mess up, because they are only human beings, but they mess up, they take a lot of people away from God.
That's so true. It's such a great responsibility. But I also know that I watched my mother and my father, who were God-fearing people, you know, and they, when they were having a bad experience, and my mother was this daughter of a Church of Christ minister.
Mm-hmm.
But when she married my father, who my grandfather called a heathen, because he didn't have the gift of being raised in the church, you know, he just didn't have that gift. He served, he was in Pearl Harbor, and he'd been in the U.S. Navy, and he said he never learned how to pray until he was in Pearl Harbor.
Wow.
So, I mean, but when she married, and by the way, can I just tell this quick story?
Sure. Sure.
It's all part of it.
My listeners to understand why a 10-hour flight wasn't enough with Patty. And I, yet, granted, even though I did sleep some of the time.
Yes,
but
you
yes.
did. Yes,
she's so much to say.
I
woke up,
much.
You were looking at me saying, I was waiting for you to get up. I want to talk.
Would you give me the name of that wonderful little sleep help that's safe and over the counter here that I've gotten? It's changed things when I get all worked up.
Right.
So it's wonderful, especially for a long flight.
Mm-hmm.
Or long trip. But what I know for sure is that my father, after he came back from World War II, my grandmother was this is not the Church of Christ side. This is the single farm woman who threw out her alcoholic husband and had to raise three boys on a farm alone.
Wow.
And she had to send him into town to go to school in the winter because they couldn't get back and forth. So anyway, after Pearl Harbor, after he came home, there was a house fire. He went back into the farmhouse. He got out. He got out with one of the brothers. He went back in and saved my grandmother and had third-degree burns his entire
wow.
body.
Wow. What a hero.
They didn't skin graft. So the pain he was in, and my mother was his registered nurse in the hospital.
Aww.
And she brought him into Christianity and knowing God.
Mm-hmm.
And how did we get here? I was going to tell you the story. Anyway, so they went through a lot of trials because they left the Church of Christ and my mother started a Lutheran church in Northern Michigan. They were the founding members of this Missouri Synod Lutheran Church, of which, you know, they both belonged to until they died and in Florida.
Did they pass away before you decided to join the Jewish people?
Nope.
No? And how were they about that?
My mother was fine because she knew that I had always been attracted to it, and to her, we're one people.
Oh,
And I think that for sure my dad had troubles with it because he said, "Well, you are not. You want me to go here? We'll go
Sure.
here." That means you don't believe in Jesus. I said, "No, it's not that I don't believe that he lived and that he walked the earth and he was just. No, that's not true. He'll always be my friend, but I believe that I personally believe that there's no middleman between me and I don't believe that there's a middleman. I'm Hashem. That's
Right.
the way it is, Dad." And they came to Tampa for my
Really? For your
reunion.
conversion. Wow.
And they're fine.
Wow.
They were fine, and they both passed away. But they really, I think funny things happen when you know that you're going to die. And they know who they are. They know they believe in heaven. I sang at both of their funerals, and they were so sure of their life after, and that their daughter is complete now. And I was
That's
always.
beautiful.
And so it all worked,
That was a great gift that Hashem gave you, parents like that.
Yes.
So just in the couple of minutes, because I try not to go over an hour, even though I could talk to you for ages, but we just won't do it on
Same time.
on the radio.
We should talk
What
about
you're
now.
doing here exactly.
Yeah.
So in the last few weeks, what have you been doing here in Israel?
I knew that I had to come. It wasn't even a choice. I just knew that I had to come. I started connecting with the people I know here, from an interior designer who lives in Netanya, who was California raised in Israel with a Californian mother. There's a lot of Americans who were raised here from California, and I connected with her. I connected with Karen, who is on one of the units, running all over doing women's tours and things for the American Jewish groups that we brought. And I connected with everybody I knew. And
And you hadn't been here since for a few years,
I
right?
hadn't been here for several years.
Right,
And
okay.
then I connected with, and I was one of the first in October, a volunteer organization that some of us, if we're my age, we're more Facebook oriented. And I don't like Facebook. I like it. I don't like it for the wrong, I like it. I don't like it for the right reasons. But I love it for the reasons that I need it when I need it.
For the
And
reason it was invented, which is to connect people who might have lost touch with each other. That's the
yes,
basic reason it was invented. Right.
that's correct. It's
Right.
just not the same. It's a lot of evil stuff. And I realized I started connecting with people, and I connected with Sword of Iron.
Oh, that's great
That's
sight.
very, very important.
Yeah.
Because Sword of Iron, again, this is a miraculous thing. This gal that I've met and spent some time with now, from Texas, a Texas Jew, was coming here because her brother was going to serve in the IDF Jewish, and she hadn't spent a lot of time here, and she was here for our, she was I think she arrived like October 2nd or something.
Right.
She was
She was here for the
here,
holidays.
here
Yeah.
for and jump in because if I'm missing anything
No,
important,
she just started this Facebook page called
started
Sword of Iron, which is the English translation of the name for this war. To coordinate volunteers because people are coming. I want to do this and I want to do that. Where do I
with a
go? With whom am
spreadsheet
I in
and an
touch?
Israeli friend and his one
Updating
Israeli
all
friend.
the time. Yeah.
Correct. And it
Awesome.
started with 160 of us, and now they're over 19,000.
Yeah. And people put their experiences. I stayed here. It cost me this. The people were nice. I needed to buy my own food. All the practical information because a lot of people are just coming cold.
What
They're buying a
apps? What
ticket,
apps
getting off the
are
plane, and just want to help. Yeah.
exactly from someone that's never been here in their life? A lot of American Christian ladies coming, which I just adore seeing. And because they've never been here and they always thought they'd come here for a sightseeing trip.
Right.
Well, they're on a sightseeing trip, all
Oh,
right.
yeah.
And a lot of American Jews, a lot of people from all over the world. I've met people from all over the world. Anyway, now this group. So I arrived and I knew by the spreadsheets that there weren't a lot of musical opportunities, which what I always thought that would be the first thing to do. So I thought, well, I'm gonna have to start inventing some on my own, I guess, which I have. But also, the other thing I want to say is when you come here thinking you know what you're going to do,
No, don't ever do that. I just tell people we have a suggestion sheet. This is what we think is going to happen. And the greatest things that will happen on that day are the ones that are not on the paper. The people we just happened to meet, and that there was traffic, so we went a different way and did something else. And you just have to flow with it.
Fluid,
Yes.
fluid. Yeah, I just
Yeah.
posted that about fluid, and I realized, and I wrote it in when I met you that I realized looking back, my biggest angst was waking up in the middle of the night. Oh, geez, what about this? What about this? What about this? But it was more about what I was going to do when I was going to be here than about my actual worries. I'd been here enough. I knew how to get the train.
Right, you can
You
get
know, my
around.
Hebrew was elementary, but I knew that I knew one words. I was not going to get in trouble. I knew how to use my telephone. I knew how to get a SIM card up. I knew the things
Right.
people know how to do. But I didn't know enough to, I did, I also learned how much I didn't know because I really wasn't going to do it any other way. I'm taking the train. I'm not running around in taxis. There are certain things I'm going to do now in war, you know, and you have to learn about things. So anyway, I put out a word to Israel. Some of my opera singing, some of the leaders in the opera world in Israel, and said, "I'm here. What's the master class situation?" Because I knew for a fact one program that I'd been trying to get into as a teacher, they canceled. And so, you know, who's around? Who's helping? Are there singers that want to sing? And I had a couple of responses. Well, the apprentice program is pretty much canceled because everybody's been called up in reserves.
Right.
Another said, "We're hungry in Jerusalem. We're hungry for someone to come and help these young artists. They have nothing to do. They have nowhere to perform. You know, the most of the stages have been closed for now because nobody's buying tickets." And this was early. So I started just offering my services to do any private master classes anybody needed anywhere, including some synagogues that. The reform areas, there's a neshama, there's groups everywhere that love to,
Right.
and
Right.
for my expertise, you know, I can go in and just, I just know what to say and do. That's what I can do. What I do well. What I don't do well is picking certain agricultural products.
Okay, that's good to know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm sort of iron. The spreadsheet, listen, and I'm not technologically sound at all. I'm old enough. I never learned all this in school like your kids did, or your grandkids did, your kids did. So I started having my kids helping me, my son's helping me with these spreadsheets, taking a look and then asking him, well, this search engine will take you where? Because you've got to know how to do that stuff.
Right. And where are you going to get picked up, and what you're going to
Where are
do
you going to
that
get picked
day, or
up?
where you're
How
going
to
to stay?
put your money on your car, your cards, you know, so you don't, if the machines, blah, blah, blah. Person. So they helped me get all of this together, and I knew that coming, I would start at a hotel in Tel Aviv. I met the Maxim Hotel, and I don't advertise except that I was reading that a lot of American volunteers were coming here. So I booked it for 2 weeks, and I thought the rest. And I'm here for almost 6. I said the rest, you know, will be. I'll know, but
And I don't know if it's going to end at 6 because you keep pushing
Well,
off
I just
when you're
booked
going to
another
leave.
thing. I just bought another plane ticket. So I have to go back, make major changes, pay my taxes,
Yeah.
do a bunch of stuff, see my children, take care of stuff, and then I'm coming back. So I'm coming back tomorrow.
I
So
have
I
no doubt. But
have.
so let's just go to yesterday because we were in touch in order to set this up and we were supposed to be together today. It's fine. We're going to do it another day. So where were you yesterday? You said you had a super intense
Okay,
day.
yesterday. The relationships that come in these times mean so much more when they, like yours and mine. My first week here, there was a journalist friend of mine who's now my friend who stays here, who's been here since October 8th.
Wow.
British journalist. He's a beautiful black man, kind, smart, interesting, and he's a freelance producer, but he was here doing a story for CNN, and he couldn't leave either. He couldn't leave, and he started gathering it. But he was here early, and he had gone to the Nova
He went early to the sites when things were
SN like
still
3 days
so raw.
early, like 3 days later.
Wow. Wow.
And he was at Be'eri 3 days later, He was at Aza. He was.
These are the places, for my listeners, if you're not familiar with the names, where some of the worst atrocities happened on October 7th. Beheaded babies and, you know, multiple rapes and bodies everywhere. People, families burnt alive together.
It's
beyond our
Western minds. It's
beyond
barbaric.
Understanding. Yeah. And you went? You went to Nova? Did you?
Well,
where
I went
the festival
to Nova
was?
The first time with him there. And we happened to have a meet, our guide. And this was his third trip back. He's a survivor of the Nova Music Massacre. And he'd been there twice with a psychologist and one of the groups that they go together, the survivors. And this was his third trip back, which meant, and I never, I learned more on that trip than well.
Well, you were with an eyewitness. I mean, literally a survivor to what happened.
And his first trip back to clients.
Right.
And he showed us his video that he had shot that morning. And it's his private property now. And since then, he's been interviewed by CNN and Senator Rick Scott from Florida. My senator was here with him, and he hadn't even seen the clip I sent it to him. But anyway, the way he described things and the way he spoke, and going back and things weren't like they are now. You know, it was so fresh.
Yeah.
And he showed us his footage, and changed everything I thought about, you know. I still can't put it into words. There's so many levels of trauma.
There are no words. There aren't.
I didn't ever understand that my whole life. You know, I lost a brother to a drunk driver. So I know sudden death. This is different. This is
no, this is planned evil. It's not an accident. It's not, you know, fate or whatever you want to call it. We've all experienced that. Illness, sudden death. This is
the only word I have is evil.
Evil. It keeps coming up. It's the same word I keep coming back to. Yeah.
There's no other.
No.
Medieval times, barbaric. I mean, these are things that you just can't even.
In your worst imagination, you can't imagine anything like this happened, and it did. And it will happen again unless we stop it.
It will happen again.
Yeah.
I know it's scary to think about and all that stuff, but we almost can't afford the luxury of giving it those adjectives. We can't afford to say it's scary because we're in it. We're part of it. And Hamas is evil. Hamas is ISIS. And the social media propaganda, the planned, the other war that we're dealing with. The other war.
The war for hearts and minds.
Was planned and executed. You know, there's a lot of stupid people in the world, but this part they planned because they knew the weaknesses that the Western mind has. They knew that Israel was politically divided.
Right.
They knew that there was a very liberal, traveling, entitled. I love Israel, young Israelis. I love them. I've worked with them, but you know, they've moved away from Hashem in a way that it's some for a lot of them it's only a philosophy, and that's
right.
Great. I'm not condemning it, but those are facts. Agree with me or not?
Yeah, I mean, I see it in all its nuances here. Like, I mean, yeah, like, and well, I'll do a whole show on this at some point. You know, the Nova Festival had a lot of young people there who had been raised in religious homes and left organized religion because they didn't find God. I happen to understand that. I have a whole thing against a lot of organized religions in general. Whatever, I talk about it here and there. It's still something that's information, that we need relationship with God first and foremost, and that there are things about Judaism that I believe do need to be changed, but that's for a whole different show and a different topic. In order to make that, because it's that's the key. That is the key relationship. And that I think the formal aspects of religion were there in order to provide the framework to be able to have the communities and the families and the backing in order to have it all make meaning. And that here, when we're in Israel and we've been re-gathered after a long time, changes need to be made to accommodate that. And that our young people on all of them they're not willing to deviate from the truth. I see it. And
That's what I wanted to say.
They're looking for the truth, and they won't take any other excuses. And so some of us who were raised differently are looking at them as rebels, and what are you doing? But they are adamant, and it's a beautiful thing to see. It's a beautiful thing to see. They will not compromise on finding the truth and in all their different ways.
I have to interrupt you because the thing that just, this is a supernatural moment, because I had the longest conversation with two young Israelis very late at night when I was coming back from the South yesterday about the Ten Commandments.
Mm.
And I said, you know, when I compare, I don't want to, you know what, I can't even afford the luxury of comparing anymore, but my Western mind compares because I'm a Western mind.
Of course, and, that's your...
But what I know is there's, in the Jewish state of Israel, the young, because they serve so early and their life depends on having relationship with someone else, you know, or you'll get killed. I mean, they learn community and love and respect and caring at a very early age. Most of them do.
Mm-hmm.
But this Ten Commandment thing, I really feel with all my heart that it's part of the Jewish blood, just knowing those are what Moses said to do, you know. You know, whether you go to shul or you keep Shabbat or whatever it is, that part makes sense to everybody.
Yes, because without those things, you destroy communities, because you destroy the trust between people. Yeah. And I think that, and maybe with this we'll end, and we'll continue this another time.
Yeah.
I think God is concerned about the world and people getting along with each other. And that was really the main goal of Tanakh, is to build frameworks for us to be able to get along with each other. And we see exactly what happens when that doesn't work. So we're coming at it from different ends, but this is, and I know that you've seen this, this is an incredibly exciting place to be on so many different levels, because it's so raw right now. Because we really are fighting for our lives. The restaurants are full and people are here picking lemons in Tel Aviv, and we're going and doing what we can, and we're preparing for Passover and
but
all of that.
The restaurants are not full in Sderot.
No, because people are still coming back, and the north is still, you know, the civilians aren't there. And I just met somebody the other day, and I'd sent some games and things for the people who are living in the hotels, something to do something. And there's a lot of distress in the country. But there is also a lot of hope and a lot of faith and a lot of trust between people, which unfortunately there's a few very noisy people who are trying to ruin that. The politicians and the press, maybe the two groups that are not in lockstep with the people. So for me, it's all about the people. And Patty, I'm so glad you're here because you needed to, you are one of the people, and you come with your perspective and your gifts and your additions to here. And that's what it's all about. You didn't just come to sit and have coffee. You came to give and to teach and to inspire and be inspired. And
I'm inspired. I don't want to go.
I don't want to go.
The anxiety I have is my return ticket now.
Right.
That's the anxiety. I don't want to go.
I know you're going to be back because you leave a piece of yourself when you leave.
I'm a bite.
So I think it was a great gift that we just happened to be seated together on that El Al flight. And
I
then
want to get you on my show in Florida.
You got it.
Yes. And girls, ladies, you know what? We stream worldwide over Passover. I stream worldwide over Passover. Legends Radio in South Florida, and I know radios are antiquated, but not this one.
Okay.
Legends Radio, where the legendary music lives. It's the home of the great American.
Just don't ask me to sing. That's all I have.
Everybody can sing. You have a beautiful speaking voice.
Don't ask me. Everybody
can sing. That's hogwash.
Thank you.
I love you.
Patty Chamberlain, thank you so, so much. Really. You know, just every once in a while, I'm sure my listeners know that you meet somebody that you just instinctively say, okay, wow, like just dive right in. And that's how I feel about you. And I know that this is the beginning of a very long friendship. And thank you so much, really, for everything you've done coming here and for everything you've done in the past and will continue to do. And thank you just so, so much. All right, everybody. Bye-bye. Eve Harrow, Rejuvenation on the Land of Israel Network. Thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Whoever you are, I hope you are well. And keep praying for all of us. Take care, everyone, and goodbye for now.